chapter 48, verses 10 through 12, where in speaking of Moab, the prophet said, "Cursed is he that doeth the work of the Lord deceitfully, and cursed is he that keeps back his sword from blood." Moab has been at ease from his youth. He has settled on his lees. He has not been emptied from vessel to vessel, and neither has he gone into captivity. Therefore, his taste remained in him, and his scent is not changed. Therefore, behold, the days come, saith the Lord, that I will send unto him wonders that shall cause him to wonder, and shall empty his vessels and break their bottles, and Moab shall be ashamed of Chemosh, as the house of Israel was ashamed of Bethel in their confidence." Now, first of all, we see that a double curse has been pronounced here. First of all, a curse upon the person who does the work of the Lord deceitfully. Now, it has been suggested that that Hebrew word translated deceitfully can also be translated slothfully. Cursed is he who does the work of the Lord slothfully. Paul the Apostle said, "Don't you realize that there are many who line up to run a race, but only one is going to receive the prize? So run that you might obtain." I watch with interest the various marathons that are run across the country, the Boston Marathon and I am amazed at the number of people that start off on that race. You see the first few blocks, just the hundreds upon hundreds of people. Now, of that vast throng, only one is going to receive the prize. When it comes down to the ribbon, there's one that is going to cross the ribbon in front of the others. So Paul uses that as an analogy. They which run in a race run all. A lot of people begin. But only one is going to receive the prize. So run that you might obtain. A lot of people start running in the Boston Marathon just to get their picture in the television as they're taking the picture of all of the starters, and they have no intention of even finishing the race. They'll run for a few blocks and then they'll drop out, but they can always wear a t-shirt, "I ran in the Boston Marathon," you know. But they have really no intention of finishing the race. And so many have really no intention of winning the race. It's just, you know, an exercise. So you go out and you run it. And there's no real thought of winning. No real pushing. But just to run for the sake of saying, "I ran in the Boston Marathon." Paul said, don't let your life be that way. Don't just, you know, say, "Well, you know, I was there." But he said, you're in a race. Now put real effort into it. Don't run the Christian life or the Christian race slothfully, slackly. But really put your heart into it. Put everything you've got into your Christian walk and Christian experience. Now we do observe that isn't often the case. Many people are satisfied to be nominal Christians. There is no thought of winning. There's no real effort. As Paul later wrote, "I press towards the mark for the high for the prize of the high calling of God, which is in Christ Jesus. Really pushing in his Christian experience, giving it all and giving it your all. We can observe so many people that, as Moab, are doing the work of the Lord slothfully. Their heart isn't really in it. It seems to be more of a duty than a drive and desire. Now, many of you sitting here today are guilty of just that, doing the work of the Lord slothfully. Your commitment to Christ on a scale of 1 to 10 probably comes in somewhere around 5 or under. Christ has a place in your heart and life. But he isn't your life. You can't really, with Paul, say, "And when Christ, who is my life." Oh, he has a nice, ordered little place, and you give him a certain amount of your life and thought and time and energy, but very little in comparison with the thought and the energies that you're giving to other things. Your rating as a Christian would probably be somewhere in the category of lukewarm. You're neither hot, nor are you really cold. But it should be noted that God isn't satisfied with that kind of a commitment. The Lord said, "In the day that you seek him with all of your heart, in that day, he'll be found of you." So, God oftentimes allows things to happen to us to shake us out of mediocrity. Disturbances, tragedies are allowed many times to just sort of shake us loose from this lackadaisical kind of an attitude that we might possess towards the Lord and the things of the Lord. There are those who are doing the work of the Lord deceitfully. That's a tragic and terrible thing. And unfortunately, the media today is exposing a lot of these people who have been guilty of doing the work of the Lord deceitfully. The second curse is upon those who kept back their swords from blood. Now, this goes with the slothful attitude. Those people who will not stand up for a cause. It's sort of a peace at any cost mentality. Even if the cost is compromise. Evil is tolerated for the sake of peace. It's sort of a let's not rock the boat attitude. Let it go. What does it really matter? And thus evil proliferates. Evil often prevails in a society because evil men are active and good men are passive. All that is necessary for evil to prevail is for good men to do nothing. And thus, the curse upon those who don't get into the fight, who just sit back. Those who do the works of the Lord slothfully, and those who are unwilling to really get in the fight against evil, those who have kept back their sword from blood. Now, the prophet describes the conditions of Moab, and really, in the first two, you have a portion of the description. They lived at ease. Moab has been at ease from his youth. Moab occupied the high plain country that was east of the Jordan River. Because of the topography, it received an abundance of rain. It was very fertile land. Good average rainfall, so that agriculture was very easy there in Moab. Many times when a drought would be experienced by those in Israel, Moab had sufficient rain. In fact, you remember in the Bible story of Ruth that Elimelech and Naomi, as the result of the drought there in Bethlehem, decided to sell out and to move over to Moab, because it was an easy place to live. It was great farmland, and agriculture was easily developed in Moab. It was known as the wine-growing country, among other things. And they had the famed vineyards of Sibnah. And that is why the prophet uses winemaking process to describe the things that were going to transpire to Moab. Moab was far away from the coastal plain. In fact, this great African rift through which the Jordan River flowed, the Jordan Valley, formed sort of a natural defense for Moab. The coastal area of Israel, Egypt was one of the major dominating powers of the ancient world. The other powers were Syria, Assyria, Babylon, Persia, and the natural concourse between the two places was the land of Israel. So the land of Israel became the place of confrontation many times in history, as the armies of Egypt were moving north, or these armies of Assyria and all were moving towards Egypt. And thus there was this necessity of being strong and to stand up, or you're going to be run over. Not so with Moab. Being over there in the east side of the Jordan Rift, or the valley, they dwelt with a lot of security. It wasn't a place where other nations were apt to march. On the east of Moab was just desert land. And so there was no danger of being invaded from the desert country, which was sparsely populated. And they were just out of the heart or the hub of things. And thus they were dwelling at ease. Never really troubled much. Never troubled with the world's problems and with the conflicts of the world. They sort of lived in an easy little nest over there on the east side of the Jordan River, and had been at ease from her youth. Never had really had much of a problem. They had never been taken into captivity. They didn't know the hardship of being conquered by other nations and taken off as slaves and captives. It was just an easy life. And the consequences of this life of ease is described in winemaking terms. And so, because Moab has been at ease from his youth, He has settled on his lees. He has not been emptied from vessel to vessel. Therefore, his tastes remained in him, and his scent is not changed. Moab, the winemaking country, the people would understand this analogy very well. For in the making of the wine, first of all, the pressing of the grapes, the putting of the juice into these large jugs. And as the juice begins to ferment, the dregs or the lees begin to settle down at the bottom of the jug. Now there comes a time as these lees are settling into the bottom of the jug where it's necessary to pour then the wine into another jug, leaving as much as possible the sediment, the lees, in the bottom of the original jug. And so you pour off the top, the top that's been sort of refined through the settling process. You pour that into another jug. And then you allow that settling process to go on again. As the sediment that still remains settles to the bottom, then you pour it off again into another jug. And you continue to pour it from jug to jug until you have just the pure wine. Now, if you do not pour it off in time, if it settles in its lees, what happens is that the lees or the sediment begins to turn sour. It begins to rot. And that sour, rotten taste begins to permeate the flavor of the whole jug. So that the wine begins to smell rotten and taste rotten because it had settled in its lees. It had stayed in the lees too long, and the lees then tasted and scented the whole wine, and it was just sour, smelly wine. And thus, this process of refining, pouring from vessel to vessel, what was a part of the refining process for good wine. And thus the prophet uses it to describe the processes of God in the refining and the purifying of his people. Moab had become rotten. He had settled in his lees. The life of ease had weakened him. No conflicts, no disturbances, they had become spoiled. And now he says the vessel is to be broken. In the end of the chapter, he said that Moab shall cease to be a people. How many of you have met a Moabite lately? They've ceased to be a people. Once a numerous and prosperous nation, they've disappeared from the face of the earth because they became rotten as a result of their ease. They had become so morally degenerate they wouldn't even take up a sword to defend themselves. Now, God has a refining process in our lives, and that refining process often entails being poured from vessel to vessel. We love the life of ease. So much of the products that are on the market today are designed to make your life easier, so that you might have more free time for yourself and your own pursuits. We hear the phrases, "Oh, take it easy, man. easy does it, bro. You know, and it's just, we love that easy life. Let the average housewife compare her life with the average housewife of 100 years ago. Just keeping the clothes for your family, for instance. In those days, they didn't have as many ready-made garments as we have today. Most of the clothes were hand-sewn on the old treadle sewing machine. You'd buy the pattern or you'd make the pattern and you would sew the clothes for your family. The clothes were washed in tubs. Many times the water was drawn from the old pump in the backyard, put on the wooden stove to heat. And they had what they called a scrub board. And the clothes would be scrubbed on these scrub boards in these tubs and then rinsed out and then hung out on a clothesline. Some of you don't even know what a clothesline is. And then gathered in all wrinkled. And so you'd have to sprinkle them and roll them and let them get sort of a certain degree of dampness, and then you'd heat the old iron on the wooden stove and keep having to put it back on the stove to heat and iron the clothes. And it was a long process. Laundry was a good part of the week's work. And then the fixing of the food for the family. Again, no box cereals. You cooked the old-fashioned oats on the wood stove. And they didn't even have the one-minute oats. Old-fashioned. And it would take half to three-quarters of an hour to get those oats tender enough to chew. And then if you ran out of some food, you just couldn't jump in the car and run to the nearest supermarket. You had to harness up the old horse and buggy and take off for town, and that might be a four-hour ride, you know, to the general store. And life wasn't easy. You go out to the barn to milk the cow. You churn the butter. I mean, life was so filled. It was such hard work that the poor women in those days didn't have any time to just sit and reflect on how bad their marriage was. Or to fantasize how wonderful it must be to be married to Tom Selleck as they read the modern romances. Nor did they have time to pollute their minds with the soaps and to sit down and waste the afternoon corrupting themselves with Donahue and Geraldo. The easy life can be corrupting. And so God sees fit many times to pour us from vessel to vessel when we begin to just settle in our lees. When we get into that dangerous position of just sort of settling down and tolerating and allowing evil to exist. Now, these disturbances that God uses can take many different forms. It can take the form of illness. It can take the form of the loss of a job. It can take the form of an accident or a notice from the IRS. many ways that God has of disturbing us. But the effect and the net effect of these disturbances are to turn us again to God, to calling upon God, to a reliance upon God, to once again begin to seek God. Our lives are in danger because we begin to trust in just our job security or in our bank account. And in our idle time, we were polluting ourselves. And so God will take away the idle time. You have to go to work to help the family meet its budget. It's interesting how that so many times as we just feel so comfortable and we think, my, this is wonderful life. I've got it made now. Job security, hospitalization, dental plan. Now, this is just great. Nothing to worry about. And bam, God pours us out into another vessel. He said, Lord, what are you doing? Lord, Lord. You know, he said, well, I haven't heard from you for a long time. Just how are you doing? and we think, oh, you know, what's happening? My life is so disrupted and things just seem to be going to pieces and the bottom is falling out. As God pours us into another vessel. But it's amazing how quickly we can get settled even in the new vessel. And how we begin to adjust and all until we've got things worked out and all. And we think, oh, all right, this is great, you know, nice, comfortable, and poured into another vessel. And God continues these disrupting practices in our lives in order that we might just trust in Him and be forced to trust in Him. That we would not settle in the lees. That our lives wouldn't take on the taste of the world. And God uses these disruptions for His purposes. Now, we don't like the process of being poured from vessel to vessel. It's uncomfortable. It's unsettling. You know what? I don't think that God likes it either. And yet, He often finds it necessary in order to purify us and to keep us pure. Thus, what should be my attitude towards the disruptions in my life, the disturbances that often come? I should look at them as perhaps warnings from God that my life had become in a dangerous place, that corruption had begun, the rotting process had begun, and God has brought this accident. God has brought this condition to wake me up spiritually, to turn me around spiritually. I was in danger of being destroyed by pride. I was in danger of being exalted to the measure that I could have easily have been destroyed. And so God allows this to happen to stop me from destruction, to put me back on the right path, to cause me to once again begin to seek the Lord with all of my heart and turn towards the things of God and the things of the Spirit, to bring me back to my knees and to a relationship with Him. Moab had never had any problems and thus was never prepared when the major tragedy came, was destroyed by it. God uses these things in our lives and throughout our lives to prepare us for the future. The story is told of a little child who was found in the wreckage of a train, cradled and sheltered in the arms of its dead mother. And so they tenderly took the child out of the arms of its dead mother. But the child didn't seem to be disturbed, wasn't really crying, until they took the lollipop away from the child, and then it began to cry. You see, the child wasn't capable at that point of development to understand the loss of a mother, but did understand the loss of something sweet, the candy. Throughout life, it begins with little things, but they are to prepare us for the greater things. And disturbances come often early as God is working and using these to develop us into the pure, wholesome person that He wants you to be. God's refining process, His desire is that our lives be pure, unscented from the world, the things of the world. And to bring us into that purity, He so often sees necessary to pour us from vessel to vessel. And so, my son, despise not the chastening of the Lord. Whom the Lord loves, He chastens. And by His Spirit will do those things that are necessary to bring you into full conformity with the image of His Son. Thank you, Father, that you care and that you love us, and that your desire is for our best. And Lord, thank you that when you see us settling in our lees, when you see us beginning to compromise with the world and the things of the world, and the world begins to affect our lives and to leave its taste in us, then in faithfulness, Lord, you pour us out into another vessel. And so, Lord, continue your work, pouring us from vessel to vessel, as through the process of disturbances, you make us what you would have us to be, pure, for your glory. In Jesus' name. Shall we stand? So oftentimes we cry, God, why did you allow this to happen? There is a purpose. There is a purpose. It's a good question, why, if you're really seeking to know why. Sometimes we say it just out of, we're upset, why, as a challenging of God. But in reality, you should be seeking, Lord, why has this happened? Why have you allowed this to happen? Knowing that all things are working together for good, let us find the purposes of God in the disturbances of our lives. May the Lord be with you, bless you, and if you're in that condition of settling, may he disturb you this week for your good.